We're on the air. Let's see how the broadcast gets from the studio to your home.
I just want to hear the music, that's all.
Is it too complicated to just keep my records in the category, okay? Just put the rock and roll in with the rock and roll. Put the R&B in with the R&B. I mean, you're not going to put Charlie Parker in with the rock and roll, would you?
What does it all mean?
I don't know. Who is Charlie Parker?
Yes!
Sounds Visual is a podcast featuring interviews and long-form conversations with DJs, crate diggers, record collectors, vinyl enthusiasts, beat makers, producers, and musicians.
My name is Jeff Gallegos. I'm the conductor of Da Ka, the hip-hop orchestra. Tonight we got like 20 string players, like 8 violins, 8 violas, 6 cellists, and a double bass player. Full woodwind section with flute, oboe, English horn, bassoon, a clarinet, alto tenor, baritone, saxes, 3 trumpets and 4 trombones, a tuba player, a drum set, harp, piano, 2 guitars, and we have an MC section. In a way, we have accomplished the goal, you know, which first of all was to even do it, you know, do a symphonic hip-hop representation that sounds like it's close enough to either one that it could be mistaken for an orchestra or mistaken for hip-hop, you know. Some purists on either side have argued that. They say, like, you know, if the real hip-hop purists are like, that's not hip-hop, and the real symphony people are like, that's not symphonic music, and it's like, well, fuck all of you, you know. Fuck it.
All right, welcome back to another episode of Sounds Visual Radio. My name is Justin. Thanks for tuning back in. As you heard from the intro, my guest on the podcast today is Jeff Gallegos, also known as Double G. Double G is a Los Angeles-based composer, conductor, and producer, known best for his work as the music director and co-founder of Da Ka Hip Hop Orchestra. This group was an early arrival in the musical experiment of combining hip-hop with large symphonic ensembles, and released the album Unfinished Symphony in 2002. In addition to the prolific output with this groundbreaking ensemble, Double G has composed an impressive catalog of classical chamber music, big band, jazz sextet, and a variety of songs. As an arranger and saxophonist, he has contributed to recordings with NDRE, Everlast, John Frusciante, Nine Inch Nails, Ziggy Marley, The Heavy, Ghostface Killah, Weapon of Choice, and many others. Most recently, he has conducted for Kamasi Washington's large ensemble at Walt Disney Concert Hall, Coachella, and the Hollywood Bowl. All right, let's talk to Double G and hear his story.
My name is Jeff Gallegos. I am a 50-year-old musician based in Los Angeles, California. And as of yesterday, I'm one step away from also being an attorney at law in the state of California. I got my last step. I just need to be sworn in right now by the Supreme Court of California. So I'm now actually learning 2 different things. So I started this world really as just the guy, obviously. But I got into music through public school. I joined bands. I was luckily in public elementary school at a time where instrumental music was offered as just part of a regular day. And this was actually kind of probably an early form of treatment for ADD, ADHD, and all these other kind of like mental distractions that young people are dealing with. Because I remember when I was young, if you were a kid tapping your pencil on a desk, you know, in 2020, they send you and they give you pills for that. And, you know, in 1980, if you're tapping on a desk in a classroom, they send you to the music room and say, okay, here's a drumstick and tap that on the drum. And that'll like focus you a little bit. So I came in through public school and I really loved playing my saxophone, my instrument, that was my first instrument. And then I started trying to write music pretty shortly after that. I remember being in a class in fifth grade where I was assigned, okay, make an invention that could play every instrument in the orchestra. And then I made this weird, like, I had to do a model of it. So it was out of, you know, paper towel tubes and toilet paper tubes and stuff like that. I made this crazy looking thing with a slide and a bell and some quick keys and some valves and some strings. It was a weird, like, one man band looking thing. And then, you know, pretty shortly after that, Kurzweil came out with the keyboard that did every note of the orchestra, every sound of the orchestra. So I guess I overthought it. Anyway, I love music. I was actually more of an athlete in my younger days. Came up in a military family, and so sports was kind of important. My brother and I played sports, football and wrestling, and I tried baseball. I wasn't very good at it, but I really do like baseball, but I wasn't, you know, keep the ball out of my hand. Like if anything that touches a ball, I'm not very good at, but I'll just tackle the person that has the ball. I was much better at that job. But then I eventually made a choice to go towards music, and I'm glad I did that because jazz is a lot easier on the knees than football. And so I started getting really into it. It became a mental health tool. My parents were split up. By the time I was 11 and I had a young baby sister who was a year old and my younger brother was 8. And so there's a lot of stress at the house. And music became kind of a life raft to get me through those years. And as a result, I ended up just spending a lot of time on my sax and then ended up getting good enough at it to go to music school. I got a scholarship to Berklee College of Music. And where I got turned on to arranging and composition, which I really love. I got to give it up to my high school music teacher, Orlando Otis. And I met him. I was a student at Gateway High School in Aurora, Colorado. I was originally born in Hawaii, but we ended up in Colorado through the United States Air Force. And my family is originally from LA, from Southern California. And so we have this kind of like connect the dots between California and Colorado for me growing up. So I spent a lot of time in California, and then I went to school in Colorado. From that point, I had a teacher who was just like really kind of put me on the right track. You know, like I said, things were stressful and I was I'm a big dude and I was kind of jacked up on adrenaline and puberty and hormones and anger and all that stuff. And I hadn't smoked any weed yet. So I was just like type A as an asshole personality. And so anyway, I was kind of somewhat aggressive and my teacher, he stopped me from making a stupid decision and said, you know, just focus on your music and keep things happy and peaceful. And I'm glad I got that advice because that's still, I try to live by that now, especially going into the law field. I'm really going to need that mental health. And so I'm thankful to come at it from a musical point of view. Time in college, learned how to write. And so I found that, you know, I'm an okay saxophonist. I sound pretty good on baritone sax, I think. And so I can function in an ensemble. But, you know, I went to school with some really great saxophonists. And because I played the baritone, I ended up in the room with some of these musicians that I still consider way better than I ever will be. But I also found out that I was a good writer. And so I could write and arrange for this group of badass musicians and they could play it and make it sound good. And so it's kind of like a symbiotic relationship. Like I would write stuff that was decent. And then when they played it, it was like, oh, it sounds good to me. So great. Learn that a lot, you know, from a composer's point of view, this is like having the social skills to deal with people is really important for a composer. And a lot of composers, I think, don't quite get the training for that or don't get the message that, hey, you know, it's great. You can be a brilliant writer, but if you can't get cats to show up for your rehearsal, your music is going to die on the paper. And so I learned that, and probably just from playing too. Like I never really liked being around asshole conductors. And so when I got into conducting, I just, you know, I tried to really maintain this. Okay. It's gotta be fun for the musicians. Got to have somewhat of an intellectual challenge. There's gotta be something more than whole notes on people's parts. You know, it's like has to have some variety. And then people ended up showing up and that's how it led to this whole experience I got to have in the middle of my career. So I'll start like, so after Berklee, I was on the way to Las Vegas from Boston because I had a gig lined up at the Dunes Hotel and that fell through. which turned out to be quite a blessing because my mother was still living in Colorado at that point. And I stopped at her place after college and then ended up meeting this band I played with in the mid 90s called Psychedelic Zombies. And it was just such a once in a lifetime experience. It will never be duplicated in my lifetime, for me anyway. But then when I saw the movie Nomadland, people living in their vans, I was like, oh, this was like the Psychedelic Zombies. And there's a siren coming where I'm at right now, which reminds me I shouldn't overshare about that period, because it's a good thing I came up in the 90s. I was in my 20s in the 90s before YouTube was a thing, which is good, because now you see if you do too much, like overposting can get you prosecuted. Anyway, I had a great experience with this band, Psychedelic Zombies. We got as far as getting a demo deal with A&M, and we did a recording at A&M, and they gave us the master, and they gave us the disc, and we got a really good record. And that was like the last record that I participated in with the Zombies was called SAC, S-A-C. It was recorded at A&M Studios, which is now Henson Studios in L.A., Studio B, Studio C, with some brilliant producers. Michael Douglas and Mike and Al Productions, and then Rick Plant got us the gig. So we got as far as that. They didn't bite, and then the band kind of I drifted off. I was kind of wanting to get to Los Angeles. My grandparents were getting old, and I knew I always wanted to kind of come back here. And then kind of left. I was trying to quit music, actually. I was like, I'm going to be a writer. So, you know, here's a pro tip for anybody listening to this. If you go from being a saxophone player to a writer, at best, that's a lateral move. and that's not very high on the economic ladder, just so everyone knows that. And it's really sad because, you know, in this COVID era, what's really helped me get through it is really watching movies, man. And so and listening to music. And I think a lot of people, especially people I know, could really relate to that, man, if it wasn't for Netflix, there would probably be more homicides during COVID, just because of the cooped upness. And at least, you can numb yourself with stories. And so writers create those stories and musicians create that music. And unfortunately, you know, those people, those creators are not rewarded and revered, I think, as they should be, which is part of what led me toward the direction I'm in right now. So this is coming out of Psychedelic Zombies. I came into a band called Weapon of Choice, Lonnie Marshall, badass LA bass player, and Kefis Chancia, badass keyboard player. We had become friends early in the 90s. And then when I moved to LA in 96, Lonnie said, hey, you know, our trombone player is moving to Europe. You come and play horn for Weapon of Choice. I'm like, hell yes. And that kind of introduced me to the community of musicians in Los Angeles, of which I feel is one of the best groups of talent I could imagine. There's something about LA drummers that I just love, man. And all my friends that I've got to play with over the years, and I would try to set, especially in Weapon of Choice, our drummer was Fish from Fishbone. Just a sick freaking drummer, man. And so anytime we played, I would try to set up near the hi-hat, which normally as a saxophone player, you want to kind of get away from the drums. But with Fish, it's a very safe net in the pocket when he's sitting behind the drum kit. And, learning to play with those guys. And then I got a chance to play with Francisco Aguabea, who's a percussionist from Cuba. And between, all the percussionists and drummers I got to play with here, the time, it just was helpful for a horn player to have a good sense of time and tempo with these drummers. And so to all the LA drummers, I love you. Thank you for saving the horn player from doing that lean forward too hard thing. And it's that community of musicians that led to Dakar, really. Dakar came out very organically. It started as a jam session. I would say that our first official Dakar show, Dakar Hip Hop Orchestra, was in 1999. But there is a jam session that was happening at the Opium Den that kind of led into that. And so we would meet together, and it was kind of loose jam session vibe. And it just came from cats that we knew from being on the road and cats that were just floating around. And then in 1999, when we had like a real focused effort to get Dakar on the stage and sustain it, there's a lot of people that were kind of off the road for a second, and rent was still kind of low in LA, especially where I was living at. I was surviving on very low overhead, was able to dedicate time to write arrangements for a large ensemble. And then that came, then came Dakar, when a bunch of us got together, did a show at the Temple Bar in Santa Monica. And then it had some bumps at the beginning, but then landed on some smooth surface. Probably around 2001, we had a debut on a concert stage at Grand Performances in 2001. And then from there, we had a lot of opportunities come to Dakar in the 2000s. At this point, I'm 29 years old. Dakar had just started. And I should back up a little bit, because how this community was built before Dakar really happened around LA in the studios and on jam sessions and barbecues and stages and just gigs and all kinds of friendships being built through music. As an arranger, I started getting calls for a lot of sessions starting pretty early in my career. And so I was getting into the habit of writing horn arrangements for different artists. Then I started moving into writing string arrangements. And then, you know, with each one of these sessions, more and more people would get involved and they would need a conductor. And so that was kind of how I got in. I was in marching band when I was in high school. And so that was my first exposure to conducting. It was helpful to have that foundation going into the studio, because in the studio, it's really important to be clear, like you would on like a marching band conductor, just really clear, almost robotic, like there's the one. Because you can't see the orchestra when you're just listening to the record. And so you can hear it if it's off. And so like to be really precise was important. And I was got to do a lot of really great sessions before Dakar started. And then throughout that time, like I noticed that after Dakar was going and I got a reputation as a functionally decent arranger who could turn in music that wouldn't be too fucked up. Be a couple, you know, mistakes here and there, but you know, we would be able to get all of our work done with the time allotted, which is really important in the studio because it gets really expensive especially on a union session. If you go past about 2 hours and 45 minutes with a large group of musicians on a union session, it gets really expensive. And so it became important to get really focused and nail, get the track basically. If you don't get the track, then you definitely don't get the gig when the next time one comes around. And so Dakar gave me, although Dakar hasn't made me any money, really, Dakar has given me a decent reputation as an arranger and as a trustworthy conductor, at the very least, you know, that I can at least get the track, as well as a network of musicians and friends. And I think that's the most valuable element of Dakar, because Dakar started with 23 people. And then by around 2005, we were up to 70 people, like a full orchestra playing hip hop and funk and jazz and just basically like a funky orchestra that was not what the LA Phil was going to play. That was really an awesome ride. Like we got to play the first year that Walt Disney Concert Hall was open. We played there and we got to play there. I think since then we played a dozen times at that venue. And, you know, that's a real gift. We got to play at Hollywood Bowl. We got to go play at South by Southwest. We got to play at the New Orleans Jazz Fest before Katrina hit. So we were in New Orleans during Jazz Fest in 2005. And then 3 months later, Katrina hit. And then the venue we played at was destroyed. We got to play, got to take a mini tour. We were featured in some movies. I mean, like, Dakar was a really fun experience, man. The unfortunate part of Dakar, and this is like where me as a musician trying to do business and law without any kind of training was I don't think catastrophic is really the word, but it just was, it definitely turned out to cost. It was expensive for me to do business as a musician without proper training. And so there's things that running a corporation that there's, you know, there's actually rules and laws and stuff like that, that you need to follow. And so I was trying to do it on a whim without any real guidance. And so, it ended up costing me more than I made from Dakar. And so after a while I was like, okay, we can't really do this for, you know, unless somebody comes in and just gives me the whole nut to work with. And so that's part of why after about 2010, we played a couple of times. We played in 2014 and we played in 2016. And that was pretty much it for Dakar.
Do I do business with Mr. Hall?
No, sir. With
Mason.
That point, like I had turned 40 in 2010, and I was starting to, like, work was dropping off. This is after the 2008 subprime mortgage bubble burst, and it took a couple years for that to really impact my pocket, because, you know, after the crash happened in 2008, I was saying, okay, well, this might affect gigs in the future. And then right around 2010, 2011 is when it really was like, okay, this is what I was waiting for. It's kind of like when the Great Depression hit. The crash happened in 29, but the depression really hit in 32, 31. You know, it was like, it took a minute to ripple all the way around. And so right around 2011, I was like, all right, things are light. I had one good year, but between 2011, 2015, I was like, this is, I'm going to die on the sidewalk if I don't figure out some income. And I really didn't have any training in anything besides music. You know, I had been a bouncer before, but, you know, when I was 20. And so when you're 40, it's more painful to do that line of work. I worked in an office before. I knew, like, clerical stuff, but nobody was hiring. I tried to get a job at UPS, no dice, you know, I wouldn't cut my hair. And so finally around 2015, I'm like, I need to figure something out. And so in one of my tours, I was on the road with Ghostface Killer, and I had bought the LSAT study guide, the law school admission test, because it was kind of like just something to do while you're on the tour bus. I was never into hard drugs. I do like to drink. And so, like, okay, I better not get too turned into an alcoholic out here on the road. And so I was like, I got to have something to do with all this downtime. Started taking practice tests in the LSAT. And then started doing well on them. And so, okay, I'm gonna take the LSAT one of these days. And that was in 2007, 2008. And then fast forward to 2015, where I'm like, I need to do something. And, like, I thought, well, maybe I'll just take the LSAT and see what happens. And so I did. I bought another book, took the practice tests, and then I took the LSAT and ended up getting a good score. So I was like, all right, well, now I'm going to apply to a law school. I said, okay, what's a law school I would want to go to? And I chose Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. I didn't think I would fit in at UCLA. I didn't think I would fit in at USC. And just the cost of those two schools is just ridiculous. So I was like, okay, I'm going to check out Loyola. The school itself has a good reputation, especially around Southern California, of just being, you know, kind of turning out ready, like, you know, practice ready attorneys. And so I applied there, and I only applied to one school. Anyway, ended up getting a scholarship. I went to Loyola Law School. And then what's ironic is that while I was there, some other really huge gigs came through with Miles Mosley and with Kamasi Washington. And these are two of my friends that have played with the Ka before. I've known Miles and Kamaski since they, in college, really. And so I was kind of like the generation before those guys. And then, you know, I'd known Miles Mosley, like just really amazing bass player. Kamasi, obviously Kamasi Washington, amazing tenor saxophone player, both great composers. And so as they have developed as musicians, they've both gotten really freaking good. And so Kamasi called me, he needed a conductor for a show at Walt Disney Concert Hall. And I was in my, still in my first year of law school. I'm like, well, yeah, man, of course. And you know, we all have the same group of friends. And it's like, it was like a family reunion and a welcome break from like, I'm studying like property law, and which, I mean, one of the cases we read in property law was written like the 1500s. And so I'm like, you know what? This case ain't going nowhere, dude. I can take a week off and play this gig with my friends, and you know, the case won't dry up and rot away, you know? So anyway, I said yes to that gig, and that was so much fun, man. And then the next, that was contract law. And then the next semester, Miles had a gig at the El Rey Theater, and he needed a conductor for that. So I joined in on that one. And then I had just these little, these gigs that were kind of few and far between, but they were all very meaningful. I got to play Coachella with Kamasi, and we got to play at Hollywood Bowl a couple times, actually. We got to play Hollywood Bowl with opening for Herbie Hancock in my second year. And then when I was studying for the bar exam, we played at Hollywood Bowl during COVID. They did a show, LA Phil, they did a series of concerts, and Kamasi had written the music for Becoming, which is a documentary about Michelle Obama. And so he had written the music for that. And because of the COVID setup, they needed a conductor, because normally they probably wouldn't have needed somebody, because they would have just set up close enough to really hear what was happening. But then because of COVID compliant plexiglass and social distance on the stage, physical distance on the stage, and it was just kind of hard to do without somebody in front dropping a downbeat. And so I got to do that while I was studying for the bar exam.
Jeff, I've always been super impressed with the sonic palette that you've seemed to work with in your compositions. So I'm wondering if you could talk to us about some records that were impactful for you and help shape your sound a little bit.
All right. So I guess I got to start with Steely Dan, Ricky Don't Lose That Number, because that came out, I was probably 3. And that's the first time I can remember, because my mom always had music going on at the house. She was a big music fan. She had a bunch of, actually, I found a lot of good records in her collection when I was young. But she had that one on, and that was the first time I can remember really running to listen to a song on the stereo. Cause I had my little rocking chair set up right next to the stereo. And if there was music I liked, I would go sit next to the stereo and rock my chair. And that's the first song I can consciously remember. Like, oh, that is the beginning, that, like that Horace Silver beginning. Stevie Wonder, Talking Book, which is an album I found in my mom's collection when I was pretty young. That's an awesome record.
Heart is blazing like a 5-alarm fire. ever care. I feel like the world is turning on me. My dreams turn to ashes right in front of my face.
I guess, like I say, Saturday Night Fever soundtrack. I found that in her collection when I was pretty young. First record I bought with my own money was the Doobie Brothers Minute by Minute. I discovered Tower of Power early, probably like when I was 14 or 15. So I got to give it up to that Tower of Power record. Charles Mingus cumbia and jazz fusion, that one kind of changed my life in a lot of ways. And then, well, yeah, John Coltrane, Love Supreme, that one changed my life too. See, oh, we got to give up to Igor Stravinsky, the Firebird Suite, or the Firebird, the entire ballet. That whole ballet is a good lesson in composition and orchestration too, really. Arnold Schoenberg String Quartet Number 1. When I first heard that, that kind of reorganized my brain into thinking about music in a different way. Mm-hmm. Parliament, clones of Dr. Funkenstein, the depth of horn arranging, the kind of stuff coming from the Tower of Power, Earth, Wind, and Fire. That's actually another band my mom was really into when I was young, so I got to hear a lot of Earth, Wind, and Fire when I was little. And then, you know, Parliament was like the perfection of James Brown, Tower of Power, Earth, Wind, and Fire all in one.
Whoa! They say the bigger the headache, the bigger the pill, baby. Or call me the big pill. Dr. Funkenstein, the disco fiend with the monster sound, the cool goo with the bum transplant.
Bone connected to my thigh bone connected to my leg bone connected to my ankle bone.
I get so hung up on bones. A Dr. Funkenstein here.
Preoccupied and dedicated to the preservation of the motion of the hips.
We love to pump you, Funkenstein. Your pump is the best.
Talk!
Take my body, give it to mine.
And then I guess this Ravel string quartet was pretty impactful. And the Ravel piano trio is pretty impactful. I love Monk, dude. Like that Monk, the genius of modern music, that record. Throw two hip hop records in there that were really impactful. So the Far Side, Bizarre Ride to the Far Side.
A little Sally Walker sitting in a saucer. Oh, how I tossed that ass. Like a mission in the woods, Woody Woodpecker would if he could, but I didn't want to pass it up. To the next man, had my Walkman bumping on the 50 yard line and my adrenaline pumping like a killer thriller, driller, chiller out with the Miller Brook, filler up, took until the damn Dutch puke. Luke Skywalker ain't a sweet talker, so I got ill with my lightsaber that came in one fancy flavor. My strange behavior led to an out.
And then the Roots, Do You Want More?
Do you wanna know what goes on? Do you wanna know what goes on? Do you wanna know what goes on? Do you wanna know what goes on?
So the most recent thing I've done musically is I wrote an opera. And that was like the last major work I did. And we got it got premiered right before COVID, luckily. It was at the end of January 2020 that it premiered. First live public performance with opera singers and a small orchestra, small group. And I got to conduct it. And it was just such a reward to hear it live. And so right now, like, I'm trying to get funding so I can get it recorded. And that's kind of on the side. There's hopes that there are little like bubblings of a Dakar reunion, so that stay tuned for that one if that can happen. I know, like, just for me personally, I would love to see my friends. We've been kind of touching base loosely online and just like, man, I miss you, dude, like, what's going on? And like I said before, just a lot of my musician friends are struggling and wishing that we have gigs, you know. And so that could be a really healing moment for a lot of us, just to be together on stage and play. So that's something that's coming down the pipe. Right now, I'm kind of involved in the budding cannabis industry. I'm learning a lot about the legal issues that surround cannabis being descheduled, decriminalized, legalized, regulated, whichever direction we end up in. That is such a fascinating area, man. It's so crazy that, you know, smoking weed could lead to a whole law practice area, and it's sophisticated. It's a really difficult practice area because it touches a lot of different elements in law. A lot of issues are coming up around social equity and racial equity and areas that have been disproportionately impacted by the war on drugs. And what does that mean? What does war on drugs mean? And like how many people, like how many black and brown people got incarcerated and convicted during the war on drugs in comparison to how many white people got incarcerated and convicted during the war on drugs. There need to address some kind of a remedy for communities that were over-policed, or, you know, someone in the family got locked up for a weed charge. And so I'm trying to help figure out how to make that happen, because there's people that are struggling with that concept right now. So I'm interested in that. I'm looking forward to a law practice. I think it'll be fun. I'm really hoping I just work with good people. I mean, there are a lot of really good lawyers out there, which, I mean, going into law school, I thought going to law school was going to be like a swan dive into a douchebag, you know? And so now it's like to realize coming on the other side that, man, I'm so thankful, especially me being older, that there are these young people in their 20s that are so smart, man, and so passionate and so aware and willing to address solutions and try to help make the world a good place. And I don't know, I just hope I can take it and move it into a positive direction. I enjoy being a musician. I will always be a musician in some factor. My chops, I mean, I've seen better chops on pork these days for me, but you know, I'm gonna do my best as a lawyer, and you know, if I can be involved musically too, that's awesome as well. I got the term Stravinsky a long time ago, Stravinsky and Mingus, and that's spelled Stravingus. And so I use that a lot of different places online. I have a SoundCloud page. It's a lot of my older stuff, but it's there. That's my handle on Twitter. That's my handle on Instagram. I like Twitter. You can be a smart ass in 140 characters. We have stuff out there. Daka Hip Hop Orchestra. I have stuff under my name, Jeff Gallegos, GeoffGallegos. And so, yeah, there's stuff out there if you want to come support the cause. I have a jazz group called Ninet, Ninet. And that's just jazz stuff. And then I've on a bunch of different records, too. Like I've got to write string arrangements for India Ari, for John Frusciante, Nine Inch Nails, Everlast, horn and string arrangements, Linda Scheider, a bunch of different stuff, and self.
Jeff, it was so awesome to hear your story. Thanks so much for talking with me, man.
This is awesome, dude.
Thanks for your time. I'll talk to you soon.
Oh, man, thank you.
For an archive of Sounds Visual Radio episodes, please visit our Mixcloud page at mixcloud.com/soundsvisualradio. We're on Instagram at Sounds Visual Media. We're on Facebook at Sounds Visual PDX, or you can email us at soundsvisualradio@gmail.com.